I think somebody between Interstate 20 and Interstate 40 is going to have some ice to deal with this weekend. One of the age-old problems, we are still running with two soundings a day from sites all over the country.
What would the perfect weather computer model be?
I think it's fairly arrogant for us to think we can solve the problem of this fluid motion, the atmosphere, using, you know, these computer models.
Some of the computer-generated forecasts I see on the Weather Channel are not the best.
I cannot tell people at 7 o'clock in the morning exactly when and exactly where it's going to rain that afternoon at 2 or 3 o'clock, and that's really frustrating.
Welcome to Weather Brains. I'm David Black from Birmingham, Alabama. We are the Weather Company, a bunch of weather geeks who provide this weather podcast. This is our third podcast, the week of Valentine's Day 2006. We hope you're having a nice week. We have our whole crew, or just about our whole crew anyway, on board with us. First off, hello to James Spann. Hey, James.
Hey, David. How are you?
Well, just doing super, and I am excited that we are making progress here in the podcast. We're getting some response, it sounds like, from some folks listening to us.
Getting a lot of email. That's a good thing. And I notice a lot of people are downloading the show automatically on iTunes. That's the way I get it. I've subscribed via iTunes, and so when I plug in my little MP3 player or iPod, you know, it goes right on the box. So I'm just delighted that so many people are listening at the beginning of this, and I think it'll just get better with time as we figure out what we're doing, which might take years, but we'll get there.
And I hope we'll get better with time, or me anyway. You guys are doing super. But it's a lot of fun. It really is, and I'm learning a lot of things, and I think people listening to us are. Also want to say hello this evening to J.B. Elliott. Hello, Mr. Elliott.
Hello, David and James and Brian and Sean.
And hello. And hello to Brian Peters, too.
Yeah. Yes, good evening.
All right, JB, what are you doing on your side of the fence?
I think we ought to learn how to have a singing intro.
A singing intro? I'll let you guys do the singing.
Most of us on this side, we decided while you were away, David, that you should do the singing.
Nobody do the singing?
That's a good idea. That's the ticket right there. We had a really interesting show last week about winter forecasting, and I just think that there's so much going on with the what nearly happened across the southeastern U.S. Last weekend, and now it sounds as if we've got major questions about what's likely to happen this coming weekend. James, let's spend a few minutes and talk about the winter situation coming up. It looks like a tremendous challenge.
Oh, yeah. Challenge is always the word. And this is going to be one of those cases where I think it's the coldest air of the season coming down from Canada. One of these whopper, you know, 1,056 millibar highs coming out of Manitoba and Saskatchewan and Alberta settle down across the northern states. I notice now it's just crossing the border as we do this update, and that's going to really spread out over much of the country. By the time it reaches us, we're down here in the southern U.S. It's going to be awfully shallow, and I'm afraid somebody's going to have some ice. It might be deep enough for snow up in Nashville and points north, Interstate 40 and north, and I think somebody between Interstate 20 and Interstate 40 is going to have some ice to deal with this weekend, and that's going to be a problem for forecasters in places like Memphis and Huntsville and Chattanooga, and it's going to be a tricky weekend, I think. The shallow, cold air masses are really hard to deal with. The models really don't have the resolution to handle something like that, and you can't look at your typical critical thickness values for something that shallow. So we'll just have to sit back and wait and watch. But I think by the time we talk next week, somebody across the deep south is going to have some ice issues. Wouldn't you agree, JB?
Yes, I do. And a shallow cold air mass used to drive us crazy back in other years when we would have this situation every few years. We didn't get that too often to where we'd have a major cold air outbreak and it'd be that shallow when it gets down here. But of course, the further it gets away from the source region and the center of the high, and the fact that the upper air, 700 and 500 millibars, which is 10,000 to 18,000 feet, stays out of the west-southwest, it has more and more resistance going south, and so colder air, being heavier, slides under.
Let me ask you guys something. When you talk about colder air, we've already had freezing and some below freezing, but are we talking colder than that?
Yes.
How cold is it going to be?
don't know. But if this air mass that's coming down now had some more push to it and could come on and become deeper in this area, we could probably drop down in the teens easily. Wouldn't you think, James or Brian?
Yeah, I'd love to hear what Brian has to say on this. I think that one of the things we don't have going on up to the north in terms of where we are is a big snow cover. You know, there's not a lot of snow on the ground north of here, and that's probably going to prevent this from being some kind of super-duper cold. But I still think with a 156 millibar high, it'll be a case where we'll have a hard time getting out of the 30s on Saturday. And you know, it's going to be one of these close calls. Brian, you shared a story with me earlier today. You say you had cold air about 2,000 feet deep, and you actually had snow with that one time, huh?
Yes. I don't hold me to the exact date, James. I was working as an intern with the Weather Service in Atlanta, and it was, I believe, and JB may remember it, I believe it was either 1972 or 1973, and this would have been January or February. I don't think it was December, and we ended up with 16 inches of snow at Macon closed I-75, the the major north-south interstate highway. Had snow all the way down to Gainesville, Florida, but not a flake in Atlanta. And it was one of those situations that we've just been speaking of, where all of the normal parameters that we tend to look at, 1,000 to 700. 1,000 to 500, all those thickness values, 850 to 700, those didn't do it. You really had to look at the cold air, and it was just a pancake of cold air that was only several thousand feet thick. And by the time you get down to South Georgia and North Florida, it was only a couple of thousand feet thick, but it ended up producing a band of snow. And, of course, we're all familiar with snow bands in the southeastern U.S. If we get a good snowstorm, we tend to get a band, and it may only be 40 or 50 miles wide, but that band went from about Columbus, Georgia, across Macon and over towards Augusta, and again, as I recall, about 16 inches of snow in and around Macon. These can be tough, and the models, as James, you've already pointed out, the models don't have the resolution to handle that kind of situation.
I believe that was around Valentine's Day in 1974, and it became called the Valentine's Day snowstorm. And Auburn got 14 inches out of that, too, and we did not get a flake up here. Montgomery got 2 or 3 inches, didn't it, Brian, I believe? And
I believe so. I actually think the snow band began around Montgomery and then went up into the Carolinas.
And the people driving south on Interstate 75 from Atlanta southward had no snow in Atlanta and got down to Macon and just had a mess. It was a real surprise to them traveling on the interstate.
Got stranded, yes. Well, and I was we were doing the forecasting. I was an intern, so I wasn't responsible for the forecast. That was a great time to be an intern. You weren't responsible for that, but it was one of those things where the forecast was 1 to 2, and then 2 to 3, and then 3 to 4, and then 4 to 6, and then finally I think they just gave up and said more than 8 or something like that.
Yes.
James, I'm sitting here looking at current observations. I was going to share that we're watching these numbers drop. Hallock, Minnesota, JB, I don't know if you've heard of that one. It's in the northwestern part of the state. Right now, as we're doing this podcast, we're recording this Tuesday night, they are down to 11 below zero. And that's the kind of air mass we're dealing with. And you factor in the wind, their wind chill index is 17 below zero. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. You get up in there, you got some minus 20s and minus 30s, and that's what's going to be coming down the pike. And one of the things to remember, the cold air is just heavy, and I like to use the analogy of dumping out a big old bag of sand. You know, like you go down to the store and buy a big bag of, like, sand you'd fill a sandbox up with, and you dump it out, and you watch it spread out, and it gets really thin around the edges, and I think that's what we're going to be dealing with. And down here in the south, I wouldn't be shocked Saturday if Mobile maybe hit 75 and Birmingham's high was closer to 39 and Huntsville was close to 35, something like that.
James, you guys talk about, you and Brian, you talk about model resolution a lot in winter forecasting. What does that mean exactly? Is it just a model's ability, or in this case, inability to be very specific about parameters?
Well, you got these gridded models, and the grid resolution has a lot to do with that, and The NAM, Brian, is the highest grid resolution. Then you've got the GFS, which is a global spectral model. But those grids are only so big, David, and to try and identify cold air that's only, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 feet deep, it's just going to have a hard time doing that. And even then, if it did have the resolution, sometimes it underestimates the or underestimates the amount of cold air coming down the pike. I think tomorrow, once we get all these runs in here, it'll be a much better situation for us to take a look at it. But I do think really all the way from Arkansas to Tennessee, the Carolinas, they have a risk of snow and ice this weekend. And we should mention, too, that we got a pretty good little snowstorm coming up in the shorter term up in there on that Arctic front. JB, wouldn't you agree?
Yes. One other thing, too, that is interesting to do, when the colder air gets closer, go about 200 miles upstream and check the latest upper air soundings and see how thick the cold air is about 200 miles behind the cold front. We could check places like St. Louis, Kansas City, Little Rock, Memphis, or places like that, and give us some hint how deep the cold air will be here when it gets when the cold front, say, gets down to Montgomery.
And I'd like to mention, too, James, you mentioned the grid. You talked primarily about horizontal resolution. There's also vertical resolution in terms of the number of layers, and that's where the models fall short in being able to detect these pancakes or these thin layers of colder air at the surface.
What would the perfect weather computer model be, James?
Well, you know, get your grid down to about 1 meter by 1 meter. How about that?
Wow.
That would never happen, though.
You need a computer that would be beyond belief in terms of power.
Yeah, it'd take about 3 years to run that model, so you can forget that. And, you know, really another problem, David, one of the age-old problems, we are still running with two soundings a day from sites all over the country. And think of all the things that can happen in 12 hours in the atmosphere, from the surface up to, you know, the tropopause. And we just don't know what's going on up there. I mean, occasionally offices will do a special midday sounding, you know, at noon or 1 o'clock. But that's another big problem, is the lack of good quality input on these things. So
you just hit on one of my biggest concerns, that we can't have the soundings more often, maybe some way automated, because and also stations closer together. Because we usually have one upper air sounding, like in Alabama, we've only got Birmingham, and in Mississippi, only Jackson. So I wish those could be twice closer together.
I worked in Memphis, and Memphis really has a handicap, because they have to rely on St. Louis, Little Rock, Jackson, and Nashville. There isn't even a sounding in Memphis. And talk about a place that could use one. You know, think of that circle. St. Louis, Nashville, Jackson, Birmingham, if you will, Jackson, and Little Rock, that whole circle that I just named there, and there's no sounding.
Has to be extrapolated, sure is.
Yeah, that's tough.
And that makes me wonder what the future holds in terms of forecasting. And, James, we got an email from a listener asking about the potential of improvements for future forecasting, and this listener writes, do experts believe that more advances will be made to make for an exact forecast in terms of actual time it may start or stop raining and temperature variances? What advances in radar technology do you foresee? Will hurricane paths be more predictable in the 5 to 7 day range? Good questions. Don't think I know the answer. Do you guys?
Boy, those are hard questions. I'll let JB answer all those.
Hey, I'm going to take a nap.
Here's another question, too. Asks, will it be easier to see tornadoes on radar, too?
Well, I think the answer is actually quite easy to those questions, and that is probably not in our lifetimes. That's a big atmosphere out there. It is a really big atmosphere. They're called models for a reason, because they are just that. They approximate what's going on out there in the atmosphere, and the resolution we've talked about, and the equations. The equations don't take into account everything that's going on out there, every parameter change, and that big old atmosphere out there. Just the old chaos theory with the butterfly flapping its wings, you know, over in South Africa, gonna be affecting us for quite a while.
I think it's fairly arrogant for us to think we can solve the problem of this fluid motion, the atmosphere, using you know, these computer models. That's just this. It's not going to happen in my lifetime, and it's going to be generations down the line. We don't have the computing power, don't have the data. I just think that's impossible. So probably the answer to most of those questions is improvements will be slow in coming, but I think they will come. They'll get better. Certainly since I've been doing this for 27 years, the forecast across the board are better, short term and longer term, out to 7 days. But, you know, it's funny, when I got into this, I asked J.B., Bob Ferry, who was the MIC here in Birmingham for a long time. I said, Mr. Ferry, what's the hardest forecast here in Birmingham? What's the biggest problems? And he answered this back in the 70s. He said, winter storms and afternoon convection on a summer day. And here we are in 2006, and if somebody were to ask me that, I'd probably say the same thing.
Now, one thing I do want to ask you guys, this part of this question from the listener about being easier to see tornadoes on radar, we really can. We really have made some improvements about that, have we not, with the 88D technology, Brian?
Oh, we certainly have. But remember, the mesocyclone that the 88D is detecting is not the tornado. It's detecting the parent circulation out of which a tornado may form. And therein lies part of the problem with overwarning at this point in time. And that is that only about 7 or 8% of all mesocyclones actually produce tornadoes. So if you issue a warning based on mesocyclones alone, you're issuing, you know, approximately 93% of the warnings without a tornado occurring.
That's a topic for another day there. That could be a whole show.
I would certainly hope that there are things coming down the road and I'll get the wrong name. It's the Navy's radar using the flat panels. I can't even think of the name of it at the moment. It's not polarimetric, but...
That's not phased array, is it, or something?
Yes, phased array. You know, phased array is going to offer, I think, tremendous improvement in terms of increasing somewhat the resolution that the radar is capable of doing, and in improving being able to send out, you know, multiple signals and multiple angles all at once. You know, I think that's going to offer some tremendous capabilities. The problem is phased array right now is quite expensive, because you've got to have you know, those panels, and I've heard that those panels that they mount on the naval ships are like about $4 million apiece. So you're talking about four of those, so you're talking about $16 million per radar. And the 88D was approximately $4 million for each of the radars. So you're talking about a tremendous cost. So,
and with this country short on money now, that will never happen in our near term.
That makes me think that we're probably going to have to rely more on enhancements, improvements to computer modeling in the meantime. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah, you know, there's some advances there. You got a lot of these, you know, higher grid, higher resolution regional models run, like the WRF and the MM5 and all these things, and all that stuff will combine to help. But I'll be honest with you, David, on a winter storm situation across the southern U.S. in a place like Birmingham or Atlanta or Dallas, you know, you can have an event where one side of town has a cold rain, one side of town has freezing rain, one side of town has ice and snow, and yeah, it is just so hard for modeling to be able to handle that. I think a lot of that's just going to... I don't think there's some things we can tell you. I mean, certainly not in my lifetime, so we'll just still struggle with it. My greatest issue is in the summer. These afternoon thunderstorms we have every day, these air mass storms, I cannot tell people at 7 o'clock in the morning exactly when and exactly where it's going to rain that afternoon at 2 or 3 o'clock, and that's really frustrating. And, you know, the forecast comes out sounding the same every day, hot and humid, partly sunny, a few spots getting an afternoon thunderstorm. That is very frustrating for me.
If we had really high resolution sampling, as you guys were talking about, do you think we would be able to more accurately pinpoint the location of developing afternoon thunderstorms?
I doubt it.
I doubt it, too, especially when you put out a forecast at 6 in the morning at what's going to happen at mid-afternoon and late afternoon.
So, yeah, you know, the sounding comes at the wrong time of day for the forecast. The forecast goes out at 4 a.m., talking about National Weather Service forecast here at the moment. National Weather Service forecast is issued around 4 a.m., but they don't complete the sounding till what? Roughly 8 a.m. or so?
Yeah.
Brian, when a forecast is issued by a local weather service office. How old is that? When was it actually created? How long does it take to go through the system? And what soundings, how many hours prior to that were involved?
Well, typically there are two forecast cycles a day, 4 a.m. and 4 p.m. roughly. As far as the forecaster is concerned, when the forecast goes out, and let's just stick with the 4 a.m. forecast for an example. When the 4 a.m. forecast goes out, it's as current as it's going to be. But it's based on zero Z data. So what is 4 a.m. is standard time is roughly 10 Z. So it's based on data that is now about 10 hours old. Of course, the forecaster is putting in his own experience and his own viewing of what has transpired since the soundings were made at zero Z and the computer models were run. So he's taking into account, he or she is taking into account all of the things that have changed. You know, the cold front moved faster or slower, or the high didn't move as fast or whatever. So taking a little bit of that into account. But when they hit the enter button for the forecast, essentially it's as current as you're going to get. But as I say, it's still out of phase. The forecasts are still out of phase with the soundings because we base our soundings on 0Z and 12Z, but we don't base the forecast on that. So the morning update is usually a morning update. If the forecaster sees that things aren't coming the way they had predicted, then the 10 a.m. update is probably going to be more more current, more accurate than that 4 a.m. forecast was.
I have a question for Brian here. While we're on the subject of those National Weather Service public forecasts, who uses those now, do you think, Brian? They don't carry the importance that they used to 20 years ago.
Well, and nowadays you don't know if that's what you're getting. You know, on the internet, go somewhere, you know, think of all the different weather sites we look at, and take a person who doesn't know when they're using AOL or Yahoo or Google or, you know, I don't know, can't say for sure where some of those forecasts are coming from. Are they coming from private weather services? You know, we know where the forecast on the ABC 3340 website came from, but if I do a Google or a Yahoo or AOL, you know, I have no idea. You know, it gets your hometown forecast. If it's from the Weather Channel, it probably is not the National Weather Service because they're now generating their own. So I really can't answer that question, James. The question that I think the Weather Service should try to answer is who's using those. But I really don't know today.
Brian, why do you think the Weather Channel quit using the Weather Service forecast? I remember when I retired and before that we had a little computer box downstairs in the office at 11 West Oxmoor Road, and any time we issued a warning, it would crawl across the Weather Channel screen locally, but it would also, as soon as we issued a new forecast at 4 a.m. or 4 p.m., that's what would appear automatically on the Weather Channel, local on the 8s, as they call it.
Yes. I remember those boxes, JB, and I know that was a very expensive proposition for the Weather Channel to have.
West Star, I believe they called it.
Yes, something like that. And, you know, there was a lot of talk when the Weather Channel took over their own forecasting and were no longer using the Weather Service forecast. Some of it had to do with the amount of verbiage in the forecast. The Weather Channel had no control over that, and they kept trying to suggest to the Weather Service to, you know, make the forecast shorter so they could fit in the crawl space. Of course, I'm sure the Weather Service didn't take that too kindly, and that's just conjecture on my part, but I'm sure that didn't sit too well. So they just separated, and I must say that some of the computer-generated forecasts I see on the Weather Channel are not the best from what I've seen. I was in a situation down in Troy where they were forecasting 32 in Troy and 40 in Birmingham. That doesn't happen too often.
Well, I believe they key in on a certain model.
Yeah, one of the subjects I want to talk about maybe on the next show or something is the changes in these weather forecasts. And I think, Brian, you're right. Most people get these Weather Service, National Weather Service forecasts on websites now. I don't know any TV station that uses them. I don't know any radio station that uses them. I'm sure there's some, but not very many. And, you know, I just wonder where all that's going with the way they're, and, you know, the verbiage can be so confusing on there. And I would love to address that in more detail, maybe on the next show. Who uses what forecasts, and are these weather service forecasts just kind of fading away into oblivion since the Weather Channel does their own and most TV stations do their own? So I guess we can talk about that next time.
That would be interesting to look into, guys. Finally, this time, a special feature from your WeatherBrains friends. We thought you'd like to meet a man who really knows what consistency means. 80-year-old James Price is a retired pharmacist in Pinson, Alabama. He serves as a volunteer cooperative weather observer for the National Weather Service. Mr. Price calls the Weather Service office twice a day to report his weather station's temperature extremes. Now, when he started calling in his reports, check this out. Harry Truman was president, Humphrey Bogart won Best Actor for The African Queen, and gasoline was 27 cents a gallon. That was that was 55 years ago, and Mr. Price has been calling in his weather reports every single day since. On February 9th, the Weather Service presented Mr. Price with its Benjamin Franklin Award in recognition of his service. Now, Mr. Price already has the Thomas Jefferson Award, the most prestigious honor bestowed on cooperative observers. What made you do this? What got you into this to start with?
Oh, I was just always interested in the weather as a child. I would have done it when I was 10 years old if I'd had the means and knew it, no how.
When was the first day you started this?
January the 1st, 1951, when I started keeping permanent, continuous records.
Have you done this every day since then?
Yes.
Now, wait a minute. Let's do some math here. How many days would that be?
Well, that'd be over 20,000 days.
You've never missed a day?
No, sir.
James, don't you get sick?
Well, when I get sick, I've always had someone to do it for me, but very seldom. I get sick and I don't take vacations. I just stay here and do the weather.
Twice a day?
Twice a day. That's minimum. I check it really three times a day. I call the Weather Service twice a day. But I'll end my day at midnight.
What do you remember about that very first day you did this? Who was president?
Well, I don't remember anything about that day. I just don't remember that day. You know, that's the trouble with weather observing. Weather's not always exciting. Sometimes it's dull and it's difficult especially when it's hard to even get up and move about to go to that instrument shelter.
I get the impression you love doing this.
Yeah, no doubt about that. It's a labor of love is what it is. No, it's the pay, David. It's the money. Follow the money.
And the trips to Europe.
Yeah.
Now, you've got an official weather instrument shelter, right?
Oh, yeah. I've had it all the time. It's the same instruments, same shelter, same pair of eyes, and same location for 55 years. You see, I ran a drugstore here in Pinson.
You've kept records from one location longer, I think, than the National Weather Service.
They've moved their observation sites from time to time, but I have not. It's always been in one spot. And so that's why they say that my records are so important from a climatological standpoint.
When you started this, did you think you'd be doing it this long?
Oh, I didn't think about that. No, I just started. I've gone through, this is the eighth. I'm with my, the eighth MIC out there, starting with Horton. I knew Mr. Horton.
How long are you going to keep doing this?
As long as I can. That keeps me going. That's where the money is, David.
How does it make you feel to get this award?
Well, very humble. I mean, to be linked to the same breath as Benjamin Franklin, to get the Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson Award, and those kind of awards, it's very humbling.
You got a plaque, right?
Yes, sir.
Where's the plaque going to go?
It's hanging above my head right now. I'm here at my den, and it's hanging right above my head, and I'm looking at Thomas Jefferson Award, which I got about 5 years ago.
You have a very regular twice-a-day routine, don't you?
Well, I check. I call the Weather Service at 6 a.m. and 6 p.m., and I check my weather day ends on at midnight and at 1 o'clock on daylight savings time.
Anything else you want people to know about being a cooperative observer?
Well, it's an interesting hobby. You can do it and do it easier than I do it. I do more than is necessary. I keep averages, and I've got normals established for my station. You know, you get a new normal every 30 years. And I've got my normals established and keep up with the departure and the temperature and the departure and the rainfall on a daily, monthly, and seasonal basis. And I got all the extremes, the numbers of days, records of all types. And I've gone into it much more than you know, you could just have a check the rainfall and be a co-op observer. But I just sticking to the routine that I follow. And hopefully I can just keep doing it.
Now, I'll bet he does just keep on doing it. What do you think about that, guys?
Mr. Price is absolute wonder. He when I was in the Weather Service Birmingham office, just absolutely amazing. Always a cheery voice calling twice a day, 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. with his highs and lows. Absolutely phenomenal gentleman.
I have also talked to him literally hundreds of times while I was still in the Weather Service. And on cold winter nights, when we were concerned about possibly some freezing rain coming up or snow, he has often volunteered to call in a temperature report every 15 minutes. I remember one night when we were expecting to change over to snow late at night, he called every 30 minutes from late afternoon until about 2 o'clock in the morning, and to give us how fast the temperature was dropping in some of the colder parts of the county.
I don't think you could pay somebody a salary to be as dedicated as he's been. Congratulations, though, to James Price. He's Alabama's first Benjamin Franklin Award recipient, I understand, in more than 11 years. Pretty good.
And he doesn't get a red cent compensation.
It's the money.
Yeah, James Price is great. And that drugstore that guy ran, man, that was good, too. Going there with those milkshakes and stuff, you know, I really miss that place.
But
he is an absolute jewel, and congratulations to him. And we appreciate his work for these long years.
Guys, and he used to be the only place in town you could buy sleds.
He might need one down here. You never know.
I think he's still got some sleds that are stored since the drugstore is no longer open.
They might be handy, what, James, this weekend?
I tell you, for some people living up north, I guarantee that this little midweek thing is going to lay down some heavy snow. Even Chicago might see several inches up there. So, yeah, down here, I don't know if we'll get enough snow, maybe a little ice early in the morning. But I think every weather freak needs a sled. For one day, that big one will come along, you know.
Perhaps. Well, we'll see.
Garbage can lid.
We'll see what happens anyway. Guys, I've had fun. Thanks to Brian Peters, James Spann, and J.B. Elliott with me tonight. That is Weather Brains for this week. If you would like to contact us, our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. For all the guys with the Weather Company out of Birmingham, Alabama, I'm David Black. We thank you for joining us. Weather Brains is copyright 2006 by the Weather Company. All rights reserved.